Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I'm a resident. This is episode 171 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And this podcast is going to be continuing our US Emily Step 1 Cardiology Review Series. I really want to try hard to finish this series over the next few days, so I'm going to maybe be focusing quite a bit on that and then some Step 2 and internal medicine stuff that I have planned. Before I go into the podcast, I think I want to go ahead and mention something, right? So, you know, I've gotten a lot of requests for, you know, to try to get the podcast to like podcast apps. If you do a search for Divine Intervention Podcasts, the podcasts are now available on Apple Podcasts. They're available on Google Play Podcasts, and they're also available on Spotify. So essentially, you have it in all those three avenues, so you should hopefully be able to access it that way. In general, though, the slides and whatnot for some of the podcasts, they'll primarily still be hosted on the website. Okay, so let's go ahead, and if you want to reach out to me, again, you also reach out to me through the website, or you send me an email at divineinterventionpodcasts with an S at the end at gmail.com. So let's jump right into it. So what if you get an exam question about like a 25-year-old IV drug user, and they tell you that this patient has, you know, like a holosystolic murmur that's heard best at the left sternal border. And this patient has had like fever for like a week. And they tell you that this murmur was not present on the last physical exam. And, you know, the person's body temperature is like 101. And they give you like a CBC. And you notice that this person's white count is like 15,000. What's your diagnosis? So IV drug user, fever, new murmur, what is that? Well, I would hope you're telling me that this person has endocarditis, right? This person has endocarditis, right? So what really is endocarditis? And I mean, like, this person, right, if you really want to cut it, you know, get a little closer, this person has a tricuspid regurg, right? Tricuspid regurg. Remember that when people have endocarditis and the IV drug users, the most common valve to be affected is the tricuspid valve. And the reasoning behind that, right, if you really think about it is, if you're an IV drug user, right, like, I mean, literally look at the name, IV drug user, intravenous. So inject into a vein, where do veins drain first? They drain to the right side of the heart, right? So the tricuspid valve is the most commonly affected valve by endocarditis in IV drug users. The second most common valve affected is the aortic valve in an IV drug user. Although in general, endocarditis tends to affect left-sided heart valves a lot more commonly, like 90% than right-sided heart valves. So what are the big things to keep in mind with endocarditis, right? So endocarditis is basically just, as the term goes, infection of the endocardium. The thing is that the valves of the heart constitute part of the endocardium, right? So, they are all lined by endocardium. So typically, when people have endocarditis, it's the heart valve effects that, you know, causes a lot of the symptoms, right? And some big things you want to keep at the back of your mind in a person that has endocarditis, right? Like, if for example they give you like a very, because sometimes, right, the NBME, they just give you non-specific questions, and whenever they give you these non-specific questions, where they don't, you know, they don't give you too many hints, you know, they just give you like, oh, this patient has acute endocarditis, yada yada yada, and what is the most likely cause. My exam strategy, or I guess the strategy I teach people for those kinds of questions, is just to pick the most common answer, okay, the most likely thing, right? So if you notice that a person, you know, over the last like week has developed endocarditis and, you know, they feel like crap and all that stuff, then it's likely staph aureus. Staph aureus is the most common cause, very high yield. It's the most common cause of endocarditis, right? Acute endocarditis, right? And then obviously they give you a question about a patient that has, you know, like an IV drug user, obviously you absolutely want to think about staph aureus. If they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has had like a dental procedure, right, and then they tell you that over the last like 3 weeks this person has not been doing well, again having fevers, new murmur, yada yada yada, then think about strep viridans. In fact, this is a, you know, I guess a factor not many people know, but actually strep viridans is the most, like, if you take if you say, oh, let me count everyone in this world that has at least everyone in the US that has endocarditis, believe it or not, strep viridans is actually the most common cause of endocarditis. But in general, on NBME exams, whenever you see a question on endocarditis, it's almost always acute endocarditis or IV drug user endocarditis, right? So whenever you see those things, think about staph aureus. So remember strep viridans. Strep viridans loves to cause endocarditis, especially in people that have that have dental procedures. And one thing I'll go ahead and mention is that staph aureus can cause endocarditis to people that
already have pre-existing like damaged valves, but it can also cause endocarditis in people that already have pre-existing normal valves. Not so with strepviridans. Strepviridans almost always, when it causes endocarditis, it causes it in people that already have like a valve with a quirk, right? So a valve with some kind of pre-existing problem. That's actually a very subtle but very high yield point you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. And then if they give you a question, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has a, you know, let's say they just had a valve replacement like 2 weeks ago, and then they're having again like fevers and, you know, the classic signs and symptoms of endocarditis, then the bug you want to think about is staph epidermidis. Okay, staph epidermidis. The thing is, when people will get prosthetic valves, remember, if you get a prosthetic valve, you're supposed to be on anticoagulation for life. Okay, so when a person gets a prosthetic valve, basically within the first 2 months after they get the prosthetic valve, if they get endocarditis of that prosthetic valve, I really want you to think about staph epidermidis. Remember, staph epidermidis loves to form biofilm. So because it loves to form biofilm, right, it can cause endocarditis especially like on prosthetic valves, because prosthetic valves contain plastic, right? So they're very good for biofilm to attach to. Now, if a person has endocarditis and they have a prosthetic valve and it's 2 months after they had that prosthetic valve placed, then you want to think more along the lines of staph aureus. Okay, you want to think more along the lines of staph aureus. And the thing is, once a person has endocarditis of a prosthetic valve, you need to replace the valve. There is no like, let's do this. I mean, they're still going to get antibiotics, but you absolutely positively need to replace the valve. If not, the endocarditis will never resolve. Okay, now, what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, they tell you that, oh, this patient has endocarditis and, you know, they have a history of like inflammatory bowel disease, like Crohn's disease or like ulcerative colitis. And then they ask, like, what bug will most likely grow in the person's... Because the thing is, when a person has endocarditis, your first diagnostic step is always to do a blood culture, right? They can ask, what bug will most likely grow in this person's blood? You want to think about things along the lines of, like, Strep bovis, okay? So, like, Strep bovis, there's this Strep bovis derivative called Strep galolyticus. I already talked about this in one of my very, very early podcasts. So, again, that's one of those big things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Although, on the flip side, if a person, let's say a person getting a blood culture for whatever bizarre reason, and you grow like Strep bovis from that blood culture, or again, Strep galolyticus, then you want to think about that. You want to go ahead and perform a colonoscopy not long afterwards, because there is a very strong association between Strep bovis or Strep galolyticus in the blood and the presence of concurrent like colon cancer or concurrent inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's disease or like ulcerative colitis. Now, if they give you, you know, a question about a patient that, you know, let's say this person is in the ICU and this person has had like, you know, like a CVC, like a central venous catheter placed for like, you know, days and days and days, and this person has endocarditis, again, like a new murmur, fevers, yada, 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 then under those circumstances, the thing, again, I really want you to think about is staph aureus, okay? In general, once you insert like an IV line into the body, you increase the person's risk of staph aureus endocarditis. So again, these are all big high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. And again, like I said, right, IV drug user, think about like tricuspid valve endocarditis. That's the number one affected valve. The aortic valve is the second most commonly affected valve in endocarditis in an IV drug user. But again, if you're taking all comers with endocarditis, the most common side of the heart that is affected is the left side. And the valve that is actually most commonly affected, again, of all the cases of endocarditis, is the mitral valve, okay? It's the mitral valve. Again, and most times when people have endocarditis of a valve, it tends to cause a regurgitant murmur, okay? It tends to cause a regurgitant murmur. So you typically would not see like mitral stenosis or tricuspid stenosis be the outgrowth of a person having a endocarditis. It will almost always be like tricuspid regurg or mitral regurg. Again, that is, again, you may say, Devine, you're being a little too detailed here. You're being a little too particular on these things. I promise you, again, I've tutored thousands and thousands and thousands of people probably over the last like 2-3 years. And then that's not counting like the decade before that, right? So I promise you, these things are all very high yield for MBME, exams. Although the tutoring I did a decade before that, because people may be like, how are you a resident and you've tutored thousands of people for it? No, that's from like a med school perspective. I've probably tutored more for like med school exams than I have for, for college exams than I've done for med school exams, right? But again, I will strongly encourage you, keep these things at the back of your mind. They are very important for the USMLE exams, because there's this trend with the current USMLE Step 1 exam where, I just feel like these days, on the USMLE Step 1, the exams are getting a little harder, right? They're getting a little harder. Like the MBME is beginning to take these like new parts, and I'll maybe make a podcast about this down the line. They're beginning to take these new parts with the kinds of questions they're testing on step one. I'll say that if you're comparing like step one and step two CK, because again, most times, you know, they make pretty significant changes in the summer. I feel like step one has had almost like a complete makeover over the last couple of months. So again, just again, things to keep at the back of your mind. You should still use the classic resources. You'll still be successful with those. But again, just be a little smarter with your studying and actually just study harder, pretty much. Okay. So how does endocarditis arise for the most part, right? If you really think about it, endocarditis, typically the thing that happens is, for whatever reason, a person will have like primary hemostasis, like, you know, the person will have like some kind of like valve damage. And then once the valve is damaged, you begin to expose, because remember, those valves are lined by endocardium, right? And remember that if you damage a valve and, you know, kind of strip off some like the surface of the endocardium, you can expose like some collagen, and that collagen can trigger primary hemostasis, right? And when you activate primary hemostasis, you have like fibrin, you have platelets that kind of hang around the valve. The thing is, those things kind of serve almost like a sieve. They begin to trap like bacteria and all that badness, and then those things can proliferate and then begin to cause even more damage to the valve. So the thing is, with endocarditis, you may be like, okay, so if I suspect endocarditis, how do I make the diagnosis? Well, the thing you typically do is you get a blood culture first, right? So if no diagnostic test has been done in the Q-stem, the first thing you absolutely want to do on your exam is to get a blood culture. And then after you get the blood culture, you want to get some kind of echocardiogram. And likely on the MDME exams, they want you to get a transesophageal echocardiogram, a TEE, okay? Remember, a TEE is more sensitive than a TTE. A TTE, you do it on the surface of a person's chest. A TEE, you do it through the esophagus. Remember that the left atrium is the most posterior chamber of the heart, and the esophagus is smack dab against the left atrium, right? So if you put an ultrasound probe in the left atrium, in the esophagus, you'll see like the heart chambers extremely well. Okay, so again, these are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And again, like I said, classically, if a person has endocarditis, they'll almost always have like fevers on the exams. They'll have like a new murmur. They could be like an IV drug user. Sometimes they may actually give you like a rising creatinine in a person that has a history of endocarditis, because the thing is, those vegetations and all that badness, they can actually begin to embolize. And those vegetations, sometimes the body may even form antibodies against them. And then you have like almost like a vasculitis in the renal vessels. Okay, so you can get like a glomerulonephritis in the setting of endocarditis. It's usually like a nephritic syndrome kind of picture. And then some other things you may also see in a person that has endocarditis, right? You can see things like, you know, you can see like the splinter hemorrhages, right? So you look under the person's nail beds and you see like red, right? That's a splinter hemorrhage. That's like an embolization phenomenon. Again, one key thing to keep in mind is that these valvular vegetations, right, that people have in endocarditis, they can flake off and begin to occlude vessels. And those like embolization phenomena can cause like strokes, for example, but it can also cause some classic things you may see on a physical exam. Like you could see like the splinter hemorrhages, right? You could see like the Janeway lesions, right? So because many times when people are studying for step one, all they remember like, oh, what can cause lesions on the palms and soles? And then the only mnemonic they remember is that, oh, you drive a Kawasaki cars with your hands and feet. I will challenge you to maybe adjust that mnemonic a little too. I drive Janeway Kawasaki cars with my hands and feet, to tell you that Janeway lesions, it's not a rash, obviously, right? But it's a lesion that you can find on the palms and soles. Same thing with in Kawasaki's disease, you also find a rash on the palms and soles. If a person has Coxsackie A virus, right? So like hand, foot, mouth disease, that can cause lesions on the palms and soles. And then Rickettsia rickettsii, the bug that causes Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that can also cause a rash on the palms and soles. And then secondary syphilis, not primary, not tertiary, secondary syphilis is also associated with the development of a rash on the palms and soles. So that's your differential for if a person has a rash on the palms and soles on MDME exams. And then remember, and the thing is, the Janeway lesions are painless lesions. And again, they arise from embolization or phenomena. And then there's like the Osler nodes, right? The Osler nodes, you tend to find them like on the finger pads, okay? You can find them like on the finger pads, on your toe pads. And the thing is, one key difference between the Janeway lesions and the Osler nodes is that the Janeway lesions, like I said, they are painless. The Osler nodes are painful, okay? So that's a nice way to tell those two things apart. But the big thing you want to keep at the back of your mind, again, like these Janeway lesions, these Osler nodes, these splinter hemorrhages, they are all like embolic phenomena. And then another classic thing you may see like on a physical exam in a patient that has endocarditis is something called a rough spot, right? So you basically do a fundoscopic exam, you see all these red in these people's eyes, and in the midst of the red, you see like white dots. When you see that, think about a rough spot. The rough spot is actually from, again, almost like an antigen-antibody complex phenomenon, less so like an embolic phenomenon, right? So essentially, most of the physical exam findings in people that have endocarditis tend to arise from embolic phenomena, with one key exception, which is the rough spot. The rough spot, again, it's an eye finding, right? Tends to arise mostly from just, it's almost like a mild vasculitis kind of deal, where you have like antigen-antibody complexes forming. So again, those are key things you want to keep at the back of your mind with endocarditis, right? And then what are some nice ways your friends at the NBME can integrate some other stuff with endocarditis? They can give you a question, right, about a patient that, you know, has has like a new murmur, and this patient has like a history, like a Miller rash on physical exam. Then obviously you want to think about the endocarditis associated with lupus under those circumstances, right? And remember that lupus can cause a kind of endocarditis known as the Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis, right? So there's this nice mnemonic that many people use, that SLE causes LSE. Okay, I don't mean the London School of Economics by LSE. I mean like Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis. Lippmann-Sachs endocarditis, it's essentially like a sterile kind of endocarditis, right? So like the person will also have vegetations, you know, on their valves. Usually it's the mitral valve, but you know, it's sterile, right? So if you do like a blood culture in these people, you will very likely not grow any bugs. And then one unusual thing you may occasionally see on MBME exams with endocarditis is, you may see a person that, you know, maybe has like a malignancy. Typically, it's like, you know, some kind of like small bowel or large bowel malignancy, like colon cancer or like stomach cancer or something like that, like gastric cancer, right? And then they tell you that this person has like a new murmur and all that stuff. You want to think about something known as Marantic endocarditis, okay? Marantic endocarditis. The reason it's called Marantic endocarditis is that it's essentially an endocarditis that does not arise because you have like a bacterial infection, but it arises from, it's almost like a paraneoplastic phenomenon that arises in the setting of certain malignancies. The thing is, there are many malignancies that for whatever reason, like even like ovarian cancer even does this a decent amount of the time. These are malignancies will produce like mucin. And the thing is, mucin is a very, again, powerful activator of a hemostasis, right? So when you have like mucin secreted by these malignancies, and then it kind of travels in the bloodstream. I mean, obviously, if anything travels in the bloodstream, it's going to go by the heart at some point. As it goes past the valve, right, again, it can activate hemostasis, and then you form like some vegetations, right? So sometimes these things are even called like the non-bacterial thrombotic endocarditis, because they don't arise from bacteria, right? But you essentially have like a thrombotic complex form on a person's valves, right? And the person again can have signs and symptoms of endocarditis. This definitely causes like pretty major morbidity and mortality in patients that already have a pre-existing malignancy. So again, one last thing, I mean, like endocarditis takes a ton of time to treat, right? Like many of these people, you know, they'll have to get treated with like IV antibiotics for like weeks and weeks and weeks. Usually it's like 6 weeks, but that's more of a step 2 CK concept. But the thing is, because it's a chronic infection, believe it or not, endocarditis can actually cause anemia of chronic disease, okay? Endocarditis can actually cause anemia of chronic disease. So that's, again, one key high yield association you want to keep at the back of your mind for MBME exams. So personally, I think I've, you know, maybe said everything I want to say about endocarditis. Let me just mentally run through and see if there's any other key thing I'm forgetting. I don't know. I don't think I'm really forgetting much. I think I've said, at least from my mind, I feel like I've said most of the high-yield things that tend to pop up on exams with endocarditis. So what if you get a question about a patient, and then they tell you that this patient, you know, like 2 weeks ago, this patient had like a sore throat or had like some kind of upper respiratory infection. And then they tell you that over the last 2 days, this person has been having like profound shortness of breath, and that when you listen to the person's lungs, you hear crackles. And then they tell you that, oh, that you perform some kind of, they may not even tell you this extra information, but if they do, like you should, I guess, be thankful. But it can, you know, tell you that this person, they get an echocardiogram and it shows like, you know, like, massive biventricular dilation and the person's ejection fraction is like 20%. What's the diagnosis that you should consider under those circumstances? I hope you're thinking about myocarditis, okay? Myocarditis. Myocarditis, the classic, in fact, I will say that if a bug is the cause of a person's myocarditis, I don't think I've ever seen a different presentation than what I just described on any MBM exam, right? It will classically be presented by an upper respiratory infection or sore throat, and then the person will have like global cardiac dysfunction. Whenever you see that, think about myocarditis, okay? Think about myocarditis, right? And the thing is, for the myocarditis can actually, is actually pretty bad. You may say, oh, who cares? It's just myocarditis. No, it's not just myocarditis. About half of the people that get myocarditis, they end up dying within like 5 years, right? So it's actually pretty nasty. I mean, it's one of these things that can essentially snatch a young person in the prime of their life, right? So it's just one of those things, you know, you don't kind of mess around with, especially if a person is having like severe shortness of breath. So I'm saying this again, if you encounter this as a physician or a resident or a med student in the future, if a person, you know, has had like a sore throat, like, you know, like a couple of days or weeks ago, and then now they have like just really bad shortness of breath, one of the big things you want to entertain in your diagnosis, I mean, in your differential is myocarditis. And unfortunately, most times there is actually no real treatment for it. You just kind of give supportive care. Again, like half of the people that have it, they may have like complete recovery, no issue. But again, about another half, they have like, you know, pretty bad symptoms, and they may ultimately end up needing like a heart transplant and things of that nature. Thankfully, it's not as common as it shows up on, on MBM exams. So what are some things that can cause myocarditis, right? So viruses, right? If a person has myocarditis, it's almost always from a virus on MBM exams, right? So you want to think about things like a Coxsackie B virus, right? That's probably the most common MBM exam cause, even if it's not the most common in the real world, because adenovirus is actually a lot more common adenovirus is a lot more common as a cause of myocarditis actually than Coxsackie B. But the thing is, again, almost maybe like 95% of MBM questions I've seen that tested viral myocarditis, they almost always went after Coxsackie B virus, okay? Even like Parvo-B19, right? That single-stranded DNA virus can certainly cause a myocarditis. If they give you a question about a person that, you know, is from like South America or like Central America, and this person has like, you know, again, like the classic signs and symptoms, the presentation I just gave of myocarditis, think about Trypanosoma cruzii, okay? Trypanosoma cruzii. The thing with Trypanosoma cruzii, right, is it causes Chagas disease, right? And there's this, I guess, maybe like series of thoughts that I give people to try to remember the different things that can be caused by T. cruzii, okay? Trypanosoma cruzii. There will almost always be some kind of Central or South American association in the Q-stem. But the thing is, I think of Trypanosoma cruzii as a thing that causes big problems, okay? It can cause a big heart because it will ultimately cause like myocarditis, leading to a dilated cardiomyopathy. It can cause a big esophagus because it can cause something known as achalasia, okay? Where you have failure of the lower esophageal sphincter to relax, right? And that will cause a big esophagus with that classic bird's beak sign. This is something that I'll talk about when I give my gastroenterology podcasts. And then it can also cause something like a big distal GI tract, right? So it can cause like a Hirschsprung's disease, right? Because those Trypanosoma cruzii bugs, they can essentially destroy like the ganglion cells that you find in the distal GI tract, and that can cause Hirschsprung disease, right? So those are all things that can be caused by Trypanosoma cruzii, okay? So again, these are all big picture things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Many fungi, right, can cause a myocarditis. Some other like rare bugs that can cause myocarditis that have, you know, occasionally been known to pop up on MBM exams are things like Lyme disease, right? So like Borrelia burgdorferi, that certainly can be associated with myocarditis. Diphtheria, right? Like the toxin that is produced by diphtheria, believe it or not, it can actually cause myocarditis. Carbon monoxide, even like a bite from like the black widow spider, that can all cause a myocarditis. And then some drugs, right? Like they can give you a question about a patient that's on some kind of anti-cancer therapy. It's almost always a breast cancer patient on MBM exams. And then they tell you that they have myocarditis. You want to think about like your trastuzumab, right? Remember, it's a monoclonal antibody against HER2, okay? Trastuzumab causes a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy. So typically, before you start a person on trastuzumab, you need to obtain an echocardiogram to get a baseline ejection fraction, okay? So that if the ejection fraction begins to drop, you can then stop the drug. Some other drugs that can also cause that myocarditis, again, leading to dilated cardiomyopathy sort of business, are things like your anthracyclines, right? So like doxo and doxorubicin. Remember those drugs, right? They are, you know, they are very good iron killing. Like they tend to like complex with iron pretty well, right? And that iron can precipitate something known as the Fenton reaction in the person's myocardium. And again, that can cause myocarditis, and then that can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. And obviously, right, I mean, you should hopefully know at this point that you can prevent the dilated cardiomyopathy or the myocarditis associated with taking doxo and doxorubicin by giving a drug known as dextroxoxane. Dex, D-E-X-R-A, dextroxoxane, Z-O-X-A-N-E, dextroxoxane. Dextroxoxane is an ion chelator, so it essentially prevents the Fenton reaction from happening, and that can again hopefully help with preventing the myocarditis and the dilated cardiomyopathy that can accompany the use of doxo and doxorubicin. And remember, unlike trastuzumab that causes a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy, doxo and doxorubicin cause an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, that's a subtle difference that again is not emphasized all the time, but it's very high yield to know for the purposes of the USMLE Step 1 exam. And then if a person gets like radiation therapy to the chest, or they have like lupus, or they have like scleroderma, right? Or again, like Kawasaki's disease, because remember, Kawasaki's disease can essentially cause like a myocardial infarction, right? And when it causes that myocardial infarction, right? Whenever you have ischemia to the heart, it is almost always followed up by dilated cardiomyopathy, okay? So again, these are all things that can cause a dilated cardiomyopathy. And the thing with Trypanosoma cruzii, because I wonder, this is not something that, you know, they hit on too much on step 2 CK, but they certainly hit on it quite a bit on step 1, is like, how do you like detect it, right? The thing is, the detection of Trypanosoma cruzii, the thing is, there are many complex tests that you can do, but let me tell you what is necessarily high yield for you to know for the USMLE step 1 exam. Just remember the word stigot. So what do I mean by stigot? Let me spell it. S-T-I-G-O-T-E-S. Okay? Just remember the word stigot. If you detect some kind of stigot, just look for the answer that says detection of some kind of stigot in the blood. If you see that, you're pretty much on the right track with regards to diagnosing to detecting Trypanosoma cruzii in the blood, because it has like many parts of its life cycle. It has like the amastigotes, the tripomastigotes, yada yada yada. And remember that it is associated with getting bit by the Redovid bug. Okay, that's again one of those weird annoying things that your friends the NBME kind of want you to know for exams. So the thing is, so if you suspect the person has a myocarditis, actually there's one more thing I forgot. They can give you a question about a patient that has a history of schizophrenia, and again they have like the classic signs and symptoms of myocarditis. Think about clozapine under those circumstances. Clozapine, remember, it's an atypical antipsychotic that is associated with agranulocytosis and hypersalivation. It's also one high yield drug cause of myocarditis on NBME exams, right? So again, myocarditis, again, like I said, they'll have like almost like heart failure symptoms, right? They'll have like the dyspnea, they'll have like the chest pain, they may have like mild fevers. The thing is, as the heart begins to dilate, that can begin to cause some pretty nasty arrhythmias, right? So they can have like bundle branch blocks, they can have ventricular tachyarrhythmias, and again, these people can actually have sudden cardiac death, right? So that's one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind with myocarditis, right? And again, obviously, you make the diagnosis with an echocardiogram. If you want to like delineate the exact cause, you can do something called like an endomyocardial biopsy. And the thing is, when you do that biopsy, typically the NBME will say that, oh, that you see myocardium, and then you notice that interspersed amongst the myocardium, you are seeing like some lymphocytic infiltrates. If you see that on an NBME exam, you absolutely positively want to think about some kind of myocarditis going on. So, again, like I said, for the most part, supportive care, and then you hope for the best with the patient. But obviously, if the patient, you know, keeps degenerating and their cardiac output like goes to crap, then you need to consider a heart transplant under those circumstances. And I guess one last thing I'll, you know, go ahead and say here is that because people that have myocarditis, right, tend to get like, because I mean, right, like I said, you get the echocardiogram and you notice that both ventricles are like massively enlarged and dilated. Because their ventricles enlarge, that will kind of pull the mitral valve leaflets apart, right? So that can actually cause people that have myocarditis, they can actually get like the murmur of mitral regurg, okay? Like mitral valve regurgitation. So again, that's just something you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And again, these people tend to, again, just pretty significant symptoms. Like I've seen some patients with myocarditis and it's pretty dramatic. You can see people from that they were like completely healthy, completely normal, like 2 weeks ago. And then they are like in the ICU, like almost on their deathbed, pretty much. So myocarditis is something you never wish on anyone. It's actually a pretty bad thing to have. Now, what if they give you a question about a patient, you know, that has like, I don't know, let's say they had like a myocardial infarction like 3 weeks ago, right? And over the last like, you know, like 2-3 days, they've been having like pretty significant chest pain, right? And then they tell you that this chest pain is worse when they lie back and it's better when they lean forward, right? And then they tell you that as the patient is taking a deep breath, you hear like almost like a three-phase scratchy sound, right? A three-phase scratchy sound. So they may say that, oh, you're hearing this sound in systole, you're hearing this sound at the beginning of diastole and at the end of diastole, right? And then they may even give you an EKG, and you may notice that there's ST elevations everywhere in the EKG or PR segment depressions everywhere in the EKG. With all this information I've given you, what do you think the likely diagnosis is? This is pericarditis, right? And given the patient's history of a recent MI, right? And they tell you that it's like 3 weeks later, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about Dressler syndrome, okay? Dressler syndrome. Remember, Dressler syndrome is an autoimmune style pericarditis that tends to arise weeks after an MI versus the fibrinous pericarditis that can arise days after an MI. So what is pericarditis, right? Pericarditis basically is where you inflame the pericardium, right? You have like inflammation of the pericardium. And the thing is, there are many things that can cause it. Most times we actually don't know. Like the most common cause of pericarditis is we don't know, okay? But there are some other thing, and they will likely not give you the we don't know one on exams. But there are some classic, you know, like high value areas that your friends at the MBME kind of love to hit on tests, right? So the thing is, there are certain bugs that can cause a pericarditis, right? Like mostly, again, viruses, they love to cause pericarditis. If a person has lupus has, in fact, pericarditis is one of the most common complications of lupus, believe it or not. If a person has rheumatic fever, right? Rheumatic fever can actually cause a pericarditis. If a person has like chronic kidney disease and they have like bad uremia, that can also cause pericarditis. If a person has, again, like a recent MI or recent cardiac surgery, although the pericarditis after recent cardiac surgery is called like a post-pericardiotomy syndrome, but after a person has an MI, again, they can have like problems like a few days after the MI. That's like the fibrinous pericarditis, or they can have issues like a few weeks after the MI. That's the autoimmune pericarditis known as Dressler syndrome. Again, it's known as Dressler syndrome. So if a person even gets like, you know, like Mets, like, you know, like cancers in the area, like breast cancer, lung cancer, like leukemia, lymphomas, those can metastasize to the pericardium. And that can cause, again, a nasty pericardial effusion. In fact, if a person is beginning to have a pericardial effusion from like a metastatic malignancy, those people's rate of death within the next few like weeks to months is extremely high. If I've talked about the chronic kidney disease case, but one other thing that the MBME actually likes that can cause a pericarditis is people that have things like these, like connective tissue diseases, right? Like lupus, like scleroderma, those things can all cause a pericarditis, right? And again, the classic presentation is will be a person, you know, that has fever, you know, it will be like a mild fever, they'll have like, their heart rate will be up, they'll have like, you know, like a tachycardia, and their chest pain will be positional, right? And so they'll have like the chest pain that's, you know, better when they lean forward, kind of worsened when they lie back because the pericardium is closer to the chest wall under those circumstances, right? And then classically, right, when you auscultate the chest, you hear like the pericardial friction rub, right? But the thing is, the MBME exam, your friends at the MBME, they recognize that if they put the term pericardial friction rub, every human being will get the question right? So they obviously don't do that anymore. These days, they'll say that, oh, you hear like a scratchy sound. Or they can say that you hear a three-phase sound, like a systolic sound, early diastolic and late diastolic sound on auscultation of the chest. If you see that, think about pericarditis. And the thing is, typically, if a person has pericarditis, right, if you get an EKG, you will see like almost like global ST segment elevation and global PR segment depression. If the person has a pericardial effusion, they can actually have like a low voltage EKG, right? Because that pericardial effusion kind of like, serve is almost like a barrier between like transmitting the electrical activity of the heart to the EKG, to the EKG leads, right? And when a person has pericarditis, right, like the, what was the thing I wanted to just mention? Come on, Divine, think. They may actually have almost like a cardiac tamponade style presentation, right? They can have a cardiac tamponade style presentation. Obviously, under those circumstances, you would want to, you know, maybe consider doing like a pericardial syntesis to relieve the pressures around those people's pericardium, at least around the heart, right? That's like that fluid that's in the pericardium. And again, in terms of diagnostic testing, again, you get an EKG. If you really had to pick a diagnostic test on the USMLE exams, consider getting an echocardiogram for pericarditis. And you really, for the most part, the reason you get the echocardiogram is to see if they have any fluid around the heart that may be hemodynamically significant. Now, with pericarditis, right, so how do we treat it? In general, your first line treatment for pericarditis is an NSAID. For whatever reason, your friends at the NBME like indomethacin on exams. If an NSAID is not an answer choice, you can proceed with a steroid. Steroids are second line for the treatment of pericarditis. And then third line, we have colchicine. Colchicine is a third line agent for the management of pericarditis. And the reason that, because they may give you, you know, a question about you, like, this person has pericarditis. Why are they so hypotensive? The thing is, if a pericardial effusion develops in the setting of pericarditis, then that can essentially squish the heart, especially the right side of the heart. Because remember, the right side of the heart is not built for tolerating like elevated pressures very well. So the thing that can happen is that if they build up so much fluid that they have like a cardiac tamponade style situation. Remember, cardiac tamponade has like the classic triad of like hypotension, muffled heart sounds, and jugular venous distension, right? So again, if that fluid encases the heart, it will squish the right heart real well, right? And when the heart, right heart is squished real well, well, guess what? What provides blood that ultimately goes to the left side of the heart? The right side of the heart, right? So if enough blood is not making its way to the left side of the heart, the patient will become hypotensive. That's one. Second thing is, you'll also begin to observe this thing known as pulsus paradoxus. Pulsus paradoxus is essentially like a drop in systolic blood pressure by more than 10 millimeters of mercury with inspiration. The thing is, normally when you inspire, right, that lowers your intrathoracic pressures, your venous return increases, more blood goes to the right side of the heart. And the thing is, that right side of the heart, you know, like especially the right ventricle, because of that extra blood, so I'm describing the normal circumstance now, because of that extra blood, you know, you kind of have like increased pressures in the right ventricle. That sort of like bulges the interventricular septum into the left ventricle, right? So the cardiac output for the left ventricle transiently decreases. So the systolic blood pressure transiently decreases under those circumstances. So that's the normal situation. But usually the systolic blood pressure with inspiration does not decrease by more than 10 millimeters of mercury. But if you have fluid around the heart, for example, in the setting of pericarditis that's complicated by a pericardial effusion, then when blood gets into the right ventricle, the pressures in the right ventricle are a lot higher because you're not just having pressure from that blood that is in the right ventricle that's already diminished, but you're also having pressures from the fluid that's squishing the right ventricle. So that bulge, when the left ventricle, when the right ventricle is like, you know, contracting or whatever, that bulge into the interventricular septum is exaggerated because there's not many places for the right ventricular pressure to dissipate to, right? Because again, there's all this fluid surrounding the heart that's squishing the heart. So you have like a more pronounced bulge of the interventricular septum into the left ventricle. So you have a more pronounced decrease in systolic blood pressure because the left ventricle is not ejecting as much, right? And under those circumstances, you have a greater than 10 millimeter of mercury decrease or decrement in the patient's systolic blood pressure. That's what's known as pulsus paradoxus, okay? It's just an exaggeration of normal physiology because you have fluid that's surrounding the heart that's especially compressing the right ventricle. Again, you may say, Divine, you're spending so much time on this stuff. Cardiology is just one of those like sciences that if you don't get down now, you're just going to keep paying for it in the future. You're going to pay for it on step one. You're going to pay for it in your third year. You're going to pay for it on step two. You're going to pay for it as an intern or a medicine resident or whatever. And then you're going to pay for it on your like your board exams in the future and on step three, right? So it's just one of those things you don't want to neglect because you're literally going to save a patient's life if you understand cardiology. So that's why I tend to take my time with this cardiology podcast, because again, I'd rather put out a good product than because I'm trying to hurry, I put out garbage, right? So I will, at least that's the kind of promise I've made to myself that I will try to never do. So what are some things that can happen with pericarditis, right? Obviously, like, you can build up fluid, you can go to like cardiac tamponade. But the thing is, if a person has like many recurrent episodes of pericarditis, one thing that can happen is you can actually have something called a constrictive pericarditis, where all this inflammation around the pericardium is then accompanied by like the formation of scar tissue. And then you can also have like almost like dystrophic calcification within that scar tissue. In fact, if you ever get a question about a patient and they show you like an image, they love like these pericarditis like associated images. If you get like a chest X-ray of a patient, or you get like a chest CT of a patient, and you see like white that's outlining the person's heart, essentially you can pretty much stop reading the question and pick the answer choice that says constrictive pericarditis. Okay, you pick the answer choice that says constrictive pericarditis. If you see that, again, I promise you, almost 100% of the time on MBME exams, it's constrictive pericarditis. And the thing with constrictive pericarditis, right, again, like most of the causes of acute pericarditis tend to cause constrictive pericarditis. But the thing is, if they're giving you like a question about like an immigrant or whatever that has constrictive pericarditis, think about TB. TB is actually the most common cause of constrictive pericarditis in the whole world. Okay, but again, most other like I'll say like in the US, for example, one pretty common cause of constrictive pericarditis is if a person has like you know, like open heart surgery, or they have like radiation to the chest for like breast cancer or something. Constrictive pericarditis can be like a sequelae from that after like the radiation therapy. And remember, again, radiation therapy to like the chest, to the head and neck, is the biggest risk factor for thyroid cancer, especially papillary thyroid cancer. And the thing is, when people have constrictive pericarditis, classically on physical exam, they will have like one of two things, right? They can have something called a pericardial knock, right? Because again, essentially the person's left ventricle is kind of like hitting the thickened parietal or pericardium, right? That's one classic physical exam finding. And the classic physical exam finding in constrictive pericarditis is something known as Kussmaul sign, right? Because remember, if a person has constrictive pericarditis, then the ventricles in general just do not have a place to bulge into, right? So because the left ventricles are having trouble receiving blood in the form of venous return, right, the person essentially has a diastolic dysfunction, okay? The patient essentially has a diastolic dysfunction. So the thing is, in some cases, when you're trying to, like, especially like when you inspire, right? Remember, when you inspire, your intrathoracic pressures go down. If those pressures go down, venous return would increase, okay? Venous return would increase. And if that venous return increases, okay, if that venous return increases, and you're trying to get that venous return to a right ventricle that has diastolic dysfunction, as you inspire, you may actually have like reflux of blood back into like the SVC or the jugular veins, and that distension of the jugular veins with inspiration is what is known as Kussmaul sign. Because normally when you inspire, you're almost creating like this like negative pressure effect, and you suck blood into the right side of the heart. So the jugular veins usually collapse on inspiration, but if they distend on inspiration, that tells you that you're having reflux of blood right back from the right side of the heart to like the SVC and the jugular veins. And under those circumstances, you want to think about Kussmaul sign. That is a very specific finding for constrictive pericarditis on MBME exams. Again, all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests. And then again, cardiac tamponade. Remember, you obviously want to do like a pericardiocentesis for that. Classically on imaging, they may show you like a water bottle shaped heart on imaging. That's like the classic presentation. And again, if a person has cardiac tamponade, they may also have this thing called like electrical alternance on EKG, where you have like varying amplitudes of the QRS complex. And if a person has constrictive pericarditis, really the thing you're going to do is you're going to get rid of the pericardium. You do something called a pericardiectomy on MBME exams. Okay. So I think those are all the high yield things I think I want to say about pericarditis. Again, I know it may look like I'm being detailed, and I'll really try hard to keep this podcast under an hour. But the thing is, cardiology is just detailed. And it's just high yield. It's just one of those things, again, like I said, if you don't understand, you're going to regret for the foreseeable future if you're doing anything in medicine, even pathology. Probably pathology, actually, I need to understand the cardiology more than the regular, like, internal medicine or physician, for example. Okay, so I think those are all the things. I'm just trying to run through my memory bank. Is there any other big thing I've not mentioned about pericarditis and pericardial effusions and constrictive pericarditis? I mean, there are some things with like the jugular venous pulse, but I think those are more appropriate for another podcast. So I'll talk about those in a different podcast, so I don't overwhelm whoever is listening to this podcast. Now, I think maybe where I would end here is, let me just, you know, maybe go ahead and talk about the different cardiomyopathies, right? The different cardiomyopathies. So the thing is, the different cardiomyopathies are very high yield to understand, to know actually for exams, right? And there's three of them, right? There's like restrictive cardiomyopathy, there is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and then there's dilated cardiomyopathy, right? And the, like, remember that this RHD mnemonic to help you remember from the least common to the most common. Restrictive cardiomyopathy is the most restricted. It's the most, is the least common kind of cardiomyopathy. Dilated cardiomyopathy is the most common kind of cardiomyopathy. So, you know, let's talk about the least common one first. So the thing is, restrictive cardiomyopathy, whenever you see it on exams, the big thing you want to think about is anything that can cause infiltrative disease in the heart. Okay, infiltrative disease in the heart. So like people that have like amyloidosis, right? In fact, amyloidosis, this is very high yield. Amyloidosis is the most common cause, very high yield. It's the most common cause of restrictive cardiomyopathy in the US, okay? So amyloidosis, if a person has like some kind of fibrosis of the pericardium, if a person has like sarcoidosis, or a person has like, even like for example, if a person has like Pompe's disease, remember Pompe's disease is glycogen storage disease type 2, okay? People that have Pompe's disease, right, they usually die of heart failure. The heart failure almost always arises from the diastolic dysfunction accompanying restrictive cardiomyopathy. The infiltrate is all that glycogen that is just staying, hanging around in the lysosome because they lack acid maltase to break down that glycogen. Remember, Pompe's disease is called a glycogen storage disease, but if you really dig deep into pathophysiology, it's actually like a lysosomal storage disease in disguise, okay? It's a deficiency of the enzyme known as acid maltase. I believe sometimes that's known as alpha-1-4-glucosidase on MBMA exams, right? So people that have Pompe's disease and die of heart failure, they die of a restrictive cardiomyopathy. People that have like the HFE gene mutation, like hereditary hemochromatosis, they also tend to get restrictive cardiomyopathy. Although remember that people that have hemochromatosis can also get a dilated cardiomyopathy. Hemochromatosis is one of those weird, unusual causes of both a restrictive and a dilated cardiomyopathy. And then if a person has, again, like scleroderma, that can also cause a restrictive cardiomyopathy. Now, why do people get symptoms in restrictive cardiomyopathy, right? The reason they get symptoms is essentially they have like diastolic dysfunction, right? Because all this stuff that's infiltrating the heart, right, essentially makes the left ventricular compliance just go down pretty much. And if the left ventricle is not very compliant, then the person is going to get diastolic dysfunction. Right? And again, classically, right, you make the diagnosis by, you know, doing like an echocardiogram. Some people do like a cardiac like MRI, although that's kind of like an advanced imaging tool there. But yes, you can do like an echocardiogram, and then you can do something called like an endomyocardial biopsy to figure out the exact cause. Sometimes people can even do like a cardiac catheterization to try to figure out what's going on, because there's like some weird pressure gradient things that cardiologists can actually measure in people that have restrictive cardiomyopathy. And classically on EKG, right? So if you remember a few minutes ago, I said that a low voltage EKG is something you may find in a person that has like a pericardial effusion or cardiac tamponade. Well, another high yield thing on MBMA exams that can cause a low voltage EKG is restrictive cardiomyopathy, because again, you essentially have these infiltrates within the heart, and those infiltrates within the heart kind of screws you over, right? Kind of screws you over, and you get that low voltage EKG, because again, you have like contractile elements in the heart, and then you also have acontractile elements in the heart, okay? So that's like the big thing on restrictive cardiomyopathy. And one trick I guess I kind of give people that, you know, sort of helps them remember it pretty well is just remember the term like ROSIS. So the word like ROSE, right? Like R, that's restrictive, and then OSIS. The thing is, most things that cause restrictive cardiomyopathy on MBMA exams, they end in OSIS for some reason. Hemochromatosis, sarcoidosis, amyloidosis, right? So those are all things that can cause a restrictive cardiomyopathy. And really, there's no big treatment. I mean, ultimately, these people are going to degenerate and die if they don't get a heart transplant. That's pretty much it. Again, I know it kind of sounds a callous on my end, but yeah, there's just really no treatment, unfortunately, for restrictive cardiomyopathy. Although there are some newfangled treatments that are coming out that may actually improve survival, maybe like in a few years. But again, it's not something you're going to see on the those will probably not make their way to like first aid for like a couple of years. So just go ahead and throw that out there, because I'm certainly aware of some treatments that are down the coming down the pike that may actually help under these circumstances. I mean, like, obviously, if a person has like restrictive cardiomyopathy from like an under like a cause, you know, then obviously you're going to treat it. If it's something you can treat, you treat, right? So say for example, a person has like hemochromatosis that's causing a restrictive cardiomyopathy, obviously you're going to do phlebotomy to, you know, hopefully help those people with the hemochromatosis. But again, most cases of restrictive cardiomyopathy, nothing you can do. Patient's going to need a transplant at some point in their lives, unfortunately. Now, so I've talked about the R. And again, that R mnemonic, like, oh, like restrictive cardiomyopathy, like the causes all end in osis. That rule also kind of works for like restrictive lung diseases, right? Most causes of restrictive lung disease, believe it or not, they all end in osis, pulmonary fibrosis, this osis, sarcoidosis, asbestosis, pneumoconiosis, right? Those things all cause restrictive lung disease. So now let's talk about HCM, right? So like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, this one, the presentation, right? If you get it wrong on an exam, after you take the exam, you know, go home and, you know, kind of cry somewhere in the corner. It's a pretty classic presentation, pretty easy, right? It'll be an athlete that, you know, that collapses during a game or something like that, right? Or collapses while they are working out, like a young person, right? I mean, this is literally the most common cause, very high yield. It's the most common cause of death in a, like sudden death in a young athlete. And really for the most part, what are some key things you want to know about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? You want to know that it's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, okay? And there are some classic proteins that tend to be mutated, right? So things like myosin binding protein C, right? Or like the beta myosin heavy chain. Those are the two classic proteins on MBM exams that are mutated in people that have dilated cardiomyopathy, right? And I mean, if they're asking you about chromosomes, you know, like chromosome 11, like most of those gene mutations are like on chromosome 11 that give rise to a hypertrophic or cardiomyopathy. Sometimes instead of asking about like those specific proteins I just mentioned, sometimes your friends at the MBME, they may just say that, oh, you know, this person has like what's the underlying pathophysiology, and the answer may be like to choose something that says that they have a mutation in like sarcomere proteins. Okay, that's another thing you may also see on an MBME exam. And what are some classic things that happens in people that happen in people that have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? Well, some classic things that happen are things like, let me tell you that like people that have HCM, I'm not gonna keep saying hypertrophic cardiomyopathy because I wanna again try to keep this short. But basically, those people tend to have like asymmetric hypertrophy of the interventricular septum. Okay, asymmetric hypertrophy of the interventricular septum. So you may say, Divine, why do I care about that? Well, here's why you care. The reason why you care is for another boss phrase that I want to talk about, and it's this whole concept of SAM, okay? Not like Uncle Sam that takes taxes every year, but more like SAM, standing for systolic anterior motion, systolic motion of the anterior mitral valve leaflet. That's what SAM stands for, right? So the thing that happens with SAM is that when a person that has HCM and they have like asymmetric hypertrophy of the interventricular septum, during the process of systole, the anterior mitral valve leaflet moves close to the interventricular septum, and it kind of causes like a very nasty obstruction, almost like essentially like a legit left ventricular outflow tract obstruction just below the aortic valve, right? So the people will have like almost very similar, like almost like aortic stenosis, same symptoms as a person that has aortic stenosis. That's the classic thing that happens, that again tends to cause many of the symptoms in people that have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, right? So for example, they may give you an MBM exam question and describe a person that, oh, like this person is like in their 20s or like their late teens, and they have like a systolic ejection murmur. Resist the temptation to pick aortic stenosis as your answer. Okay, resist the temptation to pick aortic stenosis as your answer. Because aortic stenosis on MBME exams is highly unlikely to show up in a person that young, okay? If you see an aortic stenosis-like presentation in a person that is super young, like, you know, early 20s or late teens, the thing I really want you to think about is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And actually, there are some key differences between the murmur of aortic stenosis and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy that your friends at the MBME kind of expect you to know. Aortic stenosis, again, it's a systolic ejection murmur, same thing with HCM, right? But the thing is, aortic stenosis, the murmur is heard best at the right upper sternal border, right? So like circular intercostal space on the right, like on the right, to the right of the sternum. It's not so with HCM. HCM, the murmur is actually heard best at the left sternal border, the left lower sternal border, okay? But the thing is, sometimes your friends at the MBME, for whatever reason, they may refer to the left lower sternal border as the left sternal border. Okay, so those are all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. And then in aortic stenosis, people tend to have something called pulsus pravus aetatis, right? So they will have like a delayed upstroke of the carotid pulse, right? The thing is, you don't observe that in people that have HCM. In HCM, you actually have something called like a bifid carotid pulse. So you have like a small carotid pulse, and then you have a bigger pulse that follows up afterwards. I'm almost at 55 minutes. Yeah, I'm sorry, but it will take a while to explain the pathophys there. Maybe I'll talk about it in maybe like the follow-up or cardio podcast. But let's keep going, right? And then the final thing is that the murmur of aortic stenosis tends to radiate to the carotids, okay? The murmur of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy does not radiate to the carotids, okay? That's, again, another high-yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind. And actually, one thing that just dropped in my mind is, remember that if a person has aortic stenosis, right? Anything that increases preload, right, is going to actually make the murmur sound louder, right? Because think about it, right? So let's say you go from standing to a supine position, right? So that will like get more blood from your legs to your heart, right? So that will increase venous return. So that will like increase like the end diastolic volume, right? Or if a person is on, taking like a beta blocker, right? Or if a person is like squatting, or like they have like a forceful handshake, those things all let me remove the forceful handshake thing. But if you squat, or if you lie back, or if you take like a beta blocker, right, those things will all increase preload, because again, if you take a beta blocker, right, your heart will slow down. If your heart slows down, you spend more time in diastole, right, so your end diastolic volume will be big, right? If you put more blood in the left ventricle, there'll be more blood to flow across the stenotic aortic valve, right, so that'll make the murmur sound louder. Not so with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. When a person has HCM, anything that puts more blood in the left ventricle will actually make the murmur sound softer. Okay, because the reasoning behind that is when you have more blood in the left ventricle, that prevents that anterior mitral valve leaflet from contacting the asymmetrically hypertrophied interventricular septum during the process of systole. Okay, so that's one actually, again, pretty high yield thing you want to keep at the back of your mind with MBME exams, right? So basically, anything that ups your preload will make the murmur of aortic stenosis worse. Anything that ups your preload, sound louder, right? Anything that ups your preload will make the murmur of HCM actually sound softer, okay? And again, these people that have HCM, right, they tend to, again, just kind of like, young athlete passes out on the field and maybe dies instantly or whatever. And you may say, like, why do these people die instantly? Well, they die for many reasons, right? Like, they have symptoms first and foremost because they have a diastolic dysfunction, right? They have a diastolic dysfunction. The hypertrophied left ventricle, right, doesn't fill very well with blood. That's one. Two is that dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction that happens below the aortic valve, again, can essentially like cut down on your cardiac output. And if that happens, guess what? You will have almost like signs and symptoms of like aortic stenosis, right? Like you have aortic stenosis like symptoms. Like the person will have like, they'll have like syncope, they'll have like angina, right? But the thing that tends to like kill them, you know, pretty quickly is that, like really nasty ventricular arrhythmias, right? Because the thing is, in that interventricular septum, right, like they have like this like myocardial disarray. In fact, keep that buzzword at the back of your mind, right? Like they'll say like, what would you expect on histology in a patient with a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy? You'll actually find like disarrayed myocardial fibers. They're like kind of all over the place on histology. Those disarrayed myocardial fibers, they can actually cause like some weird conduction defects, right? And a person can get like VFib or VTAC and die, Okay, that is why in general, when a person is HCM, the classic treatment is they'll tell you, just stop strenuous exercise. So if you're an athlete, stop athleting pretty much. And then any drug that can tank your preload is bad, right? Any drug that can tank your preload, right? So like taking like a diuretic, for example, right? Or taking like a nitrate, like nitroprusside, it's not a great idea for those people because that will cause venodilation. That will decrease preload. That will bring, if you have decreased preload, your end diastolic volume will decrease. And that will bring that anterior leaflet of the mitral valve close to the asymmetrically hypertrophied interventricular septum. And that can worsen the left ventricular outflow tract obstruction. So in general, you give these people beta blockers because again, beta blockers, they'll slow the heart down. If you slow the heart down, you'll have more time to fill, right? You'll spend more time in diastole. So the heart will fill with more blood. Okay, and again, that will prevent that dynamic LVOT that I just described a few moments ago, right? And then again, if these people are having like these nasty like VFib, VTach arrhythmias, which again tends to cause like their death, you can, put like an ICD in place. You can put like a defibrillator in their hearts. And one unusual thing that is tested more commonly on step two, but occasionally may pop up on step one is, if you actually have a first degree relative with HCM, they do need to be, let's say they give you a question about a patient with HCM. Every first degree relative has to be screened with an echocardiogram. Because again, remember, it's autosomal dominant inheritance, okay? So again, just one of those weird high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Same thing with like the MEN syndromes, right? Like MEN2A and 2B. It's an autosomal dominant disease. You do need to screen first degree family members for the same disease. And I mean HCM, like some people do like alcohol ablations and all that stuff, but they probably won't go there on MBME exams. But again, I promise you, you need to know as much as possible. This is probably one of the most commonly tested concepts on the USMLE exams, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. And the presentation is very similar every time. But the thing is, the reason the MBME loves to test this is it's a topic that they can literally make like 30 or 40 different questions from. Like literally, I can write like 30 different HCM questions from like many different dimensions. Okay, so again, these are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Remember, again, use beta blockers for treatment. Don't give these people like diuretics or whatever, because the reason I keep harping on this, don't give these people diuretics, is people that have HCM, they can have like heart failure symptoms, and your first temptation will be to let's give this person a diuretic to get rid of the volume. No, don't do that, right? Diuretics, even positive inotropes, right? So drugs like digoxin, or drugs like Murinone, for example, they're not ideal for people that have HCM, okay? Because again, if you contract the heart a lot, that will decrease the end diastolic volume. And if you decrease the end diastolic volume, again, that would worsen that dynamic left ventricular outflow tract obstruction that is below the aortic valve, as I've described again, multiple times already. Now, the last type of cardiomyopathy I guess I'll talk about is dilated cardiomyopathy. Again, there are many things that can cause dilated cardiomyopathy. Basically, let me make this easy for you. If you remember many of the things I talked about as causes of myocarditis, those things can all cause dilated cardiomyopathy. If you remember, when I was talking about myocarditis, I kept harping on dilated cardiomyopathy, right? But some other things I guess I did not necessarily mention is things like alcohol, right? So people that have alcoholism, right? Remember, alcohol will deplete your vitamin B1, your thiamine population, right? So that can cause a lot of problems, right? That can cause like a Wernicke-Korsakoff, right? Because again, of the thiamine deficiency. And remember, if you have a thyamine deficiency, right? Guess what? Your pyruvate dehydrogenase complex is not going to work anymore. And your citric acid cycle, your TCA cycle, also is not going to work anymore. So if those cycles are not working, guess what you're not making? You're not making ATP. And that can begin to cause problems with your myocardium. That is actually the mechanism behind wet beriberi. Okay, that is how people with just chronic alcoholism can develop a wet beriberi. Wet beriberi is essentially dilated cardiomyopathy in a chronic alcoholic. So again, all high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. I've talked about many drugs, and sometimes they may give you, although this is more prevalent on step 2 CK, they'll give you a question about a patient that has, that is like postpartum, right? Remember, women that are postpartum, they actually can also get like cardiomyopathies, because pregnancy is like a state of, if I open this can of worms, I feel like I'll have to... Okay, whoever is listening to this podcast, I apologize. I know this is 63 minutes already, but there is just like so many good MBME ideas that are just dropping in my brain as I'm giving this podcast. So my apologies, right? But let me maybe talk about some quick pathophys here. I was going to extend this a little. Okay, so the thing is, pregnancy, right? The way the body adapts to pregnancy is that it increases blood volume by like 50%, okay? It increases blood volume by like 50%, right? So like a pregnant woman may have a total blood volume of almost 8 liters while she's pregnant. You may say, why does the body do that? Well, here's the thing. The reason the body does that is because the body knows that in the presence of delivering a baby, right? I mean, if you've ever done an OB-GYN rotation, you know that essentially when a woman is delivering a baby, at least some of the deliveries I have seen, I mean, I've thankfully gotten a chance to catch babies during my OB-GYN rotation at med school. The thing that can happen is, you know, blood everywhere, right? A lot of blood, right? So the thing is, the body tries to prepare for that blood loss during the process of delivery by just upping the person's blood volume. Okay, so the thing is, pregnancy, it's like you are living in a 9-month state of volume overload. Okay, because, and then this is me essentially taking a sidebar here, right? I'm taking a sidebar because I want to maybe integrate another concept that is actually fairly common on the USMLE exams, right? The thing is, when you're exposed to chronic volume overload, that actually causes some changes in the wall stress of the myocardium. And those changes in wall stress activate certain mechanoreceptors, and those mechanoreceptors are tied to certain patterns of gene expression, okay? Those mechanoreceptors are tied to certain patterns of gene expression. So the thing is, when you kind of like alter the gene expression in those myocardium, you can begin to like lay down, like you can say, oh, how will I deal with this increased stress? Well, you can decide to start laying down like new sarcomeres, right? And the thing is, you can lay down new sarcomeres in different ways. In some cases, you can lay down new sarcomeres in series, which is what happens when a person is exposed to chronic volume overload, like what happens in pregnancy, right? So that can actually cause like a dilated cardiomyopathy, because the thing is, when your heart is exposed to like just chronic increases in volume, right? So like in a person that has like aortic regurg or a person that is pregnant, right? That can dilate the ventricles. And when that dilates the ventricle, that can cause stress on the ventricle. And that stress, again, like I said, it will alter gene expression and the person will begin to lay down sarcomeres in series. When you lay down sarcomeres in series, you are essentially like not making the cardiac sarcomeres interlock appropriately. Right? So that will ultimately cause something called a systolic dysfunction. Okay? That will cause a systolic dysfunction. You may see some people refer to this as HFrEF or heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. Right? So this is what happens when you have chronic volume overload. Right? And remember that volume overload tends to be associated with an S3, not S4, S3 heart sound. Okay? Contrast this. So anything that puts more volume in the left ventricle, like pregnancy or aortic regurgitation, that can cause a volume overload that will cause a dilated cardiomyopathy, which again is one of the reasons why women that are peripartum, so there's this thing called a peripartum cardiomyopathy. It's a kind of dilated cardiomyopathy that happens either just before you deliver a child or up to like 6 months after that child has been delivered. So again, those are all big, again, high yield things. Again, I know it's kind of annoying, but those are all high yield things to understand for MBME exams. But since I talked about volume overload, I think it probably behooves me to talk about pressure overload. Okay, pressure overload. So the thing is, when a person is exposed to chronically elevated pressures, right? So say, for example, a person has like aortic stenosis. Remember, aortic stenosis does not put more blood in the left ventricle. It just makes the left ventricle have to work harder to get blood out. Right? That's a different kind of overload. That's not a volume overload. That's a pressure overload. Okay? And when people have pressure, like a pressure overload situation, that again will alter certain like stress, like wall stress factors in the myocardium. And that will again alter gene expression. And these people begin to lay down new sarcomeres. But unlike the volume overload situation where you lay down new sarcomeres in series, in the pressure overload situation, you lay down new sarcomeres in parallel. Right? Because think about it. This actually makes perfect sense if you really think about it. The thing is, when a person is chronically exposed to lots and lots and lots of volume, it would make sense that you want to physically increase the cavity size of the left ventricle to be able to handle that increased volume, right? So that's why a dilated cardiomyopathy tends to come after chronic exposure to volume overload, right? But contrast this with pressure overload. When you know that you have a stenotic lesion in front of the left ventricle, like aortic stenosis, for example, then you know that, oh, I'm not necessarily trying to deal with higher volumes. I just need to push with a greater amount of force to get this blood through the stenotic aortic valve. Well, the way you can exert more force is to just become more muscular, right? I mean, think about it. If you go to the gym and pump iron for days and days and days on end, you should be able to lift heavier and heavier weights over time. That is essentially what happens to the heart when it is subjected to chronically increased afterload. For example, in the setting of hypertension or in the setting of aortic stenosis, right? So to generate those extra pressures, you alter your gene expression and begin to lay down new sarcomeres in parallel. The problem is when you lay down new sarcomeres in parallel, your left ventricle becomes big and buff, but that also takes away some of the cavity size. It's like you are trading the ability to handle more volume for the ability to generate greater force, okay? So because you are able to generate greater force, the cavity size of the left ventricle decreases, and that causes a diastolic dysfunction, okay? That causes a diastolic dysfunction. That is something you may classically see referred to as HFpEF, or heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. And HFpEF tends to be associated with an S4 heart sound, not the S3 heart sound that is characteristic of volume overload and dilated cardiomyopathy. So I really, really, really hope this stuff makes sense. This thing I just described, I promise you, it's floridly high yield to know for all the USMLE exams. And if you're going into internal medicine in the future, attendings love to pimp students on this stuff, and they love to pimp residents on this stuff as well. Like med students, residents, they love to pimp them on this. And then this stuff shows up quite commonly on the medicine, like in-training exam and the medicine board exams. Again, I know this because I tutor a lot of internal medicine residents. So again, high yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. So now that I've gone off of this sidebar, let me go back to my dilated cardiomyopathy, and hopefully I'll get to the end of this podcast. Whoops. So again, I really feel bad for whoever's listening to this. Sorry. I know this has gone on for much longer than I planned to go with, but this is a very, very high yield podcast, and it's something I am really hoping will serve you very well as you're preparing for your USMLE exams, right? So again, dilated cardiomyopathy, I've kind of said many of the big things about it. People that have acromegaly or like gigantism, right? The most common cause of death in those people is cardiovascular disease. They almost always die from, again, dilated cardiomyopathy. It kind of presents, again, classic signs and symptoms of almost like a myocarditis, like presentation, right? And you make the diagnosis with an echocardiogram. These people will have like systolic dysfunction. Their ejection fractions will all be down. It will usually be less than like 40% on an MBME exam. And the treatment is you just give them like heart failure treatment. You give them like the beta blockers and the ACE inhibitors and the aldosterone receptor antagonists. But again, if those don't work, then you need to consider a heart transplant for these people, pretty much. So I think I'm gonna go ahead and pause here. I mean, there's one more topic I wanted to talk about to kind of like round this out so that I know that I am done. Let me just talk about this last topic. It'll probably take like 2 minutes and then I'm done here. But basically, right, what if they give you a question about a patient that, has like hypopigmented macules on the skin, and then they tell you that this patient has is having like heart failure style symptoms, like a new S3 heart sound or whatever. And then they tell you that they perform an echocardiogram and then they see like a mass in the heart. What are you thinking about? I would hope you're thinking about like a rhabdomyoma, right? Essentially, the thing I'm telling you with the hypopigmented macules on the skin, I'm essentially making reference to tuberous sclerosis, right? So tuberous sclerosis, remember tuberous sclerosis, right? It tends to cause these ash leaf spots. And these people tend to have like some weird tumors, right? So they can have like hematomas in the brain. They call them those like tubers. They can actually have this brain tumor known as SEGA, like subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, right? And then they can have like the renal angiomyolipomas, right? And then these people can also have like certain cardiac tumors known as rhabdomyomas. That's what I'm referring to in this Q-stem. And then remember, another thing that's also common in kids with tuberous sclerosis is that they can get a seizure disorder known as a West syndrome. Sometimes it's known as infantile spasms. And the thing is, your friends on the MBME, they kind of expect you to know the classic EEG finding with West syndrome. It's known as a hypsarrhythmia. Okay, so that's just one of those annoying things you want to, you know, sort of lock in the back of your mind. And really, this rhabdomyoma, it's a hematoma. Like, essentially what, like many of these things that happen in people with tuberous sclerosis, they form hematomas in different parts of the body, right? So the cardiac rhabdomyoma, believe it or not, is actually a hematoma. And really, if you see like, you see like tumors and all that stuff around the heart, the thing you really do want to think about is Mets, right? So Mets are more common than primary cardiac malignancies. So Mets, because again, if you see a person, you know, they have like a lung cancer or something, and then you see like another like tumor like in the heart, it's most likely a metastasis. And most times those tumors tend to be associated with like pericardial effusions, right? But if you're, you know, thinking about like primary cardiac tumors, one other one you may see on MBME exams, especially like a tumor like in the left atrium, think about a myxoma, right? An atrial myxoma. Atrial myxoma, for the most part, it's benign. But the reason that it's dangerous is that some parts of the tumor can flake off and then embolize to the brain and cause a stroke, okay? So the classic presentation on MBME exams, it will be a person that has, you know, has been having like B-style symptoms like weight loss or like fevers, because actually the myxoma, believe it or not, can produce like interleukin-1. So that can cause like a fever. It can produce like TNF-alpha and cause like, you know, like B-style symptoms, right? But they may tell you, okay, this person is having like, you know, like has had like stroke-like episodes, or has had like syncopal episodes, and then they tell you that on auscultation of the chest, you hear like a diastolic plop sound. So plop, P-L-O-P, a diastolic plop sound at the apex. If you see that, you absolutely positively want to think about an atrial myxoma, right? The thing is, in diastole, the thing can actually cause almost like signs and symptoms of like mitral stenosis, right? Because the tumor tends to be pedunculated, so it tends to move like when blood is trying to fill the left ventricle. That's why it's classically described as a diastolic plop sound on auscultation. And obviously the way you treat it is you remove the tumor, and you can make the diagnosis by doing a TEE. Again, remember, almost 90%, I think actually it's greater than 90% of atrial myxomas are in the left atrium, right? So again, you want to be in a chamber that is smacked up against the left atrium like the esophagus. That is why a TEE, a transesophageal echocardiogram, is the diagnostic test of choice in figuring out that a person has an atrial myxoma. So I think I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for a ton of exams, right? So step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I do this thing called longitudinal tutoring, where if you're like a first, second, or third year med student, I tutor you for like your block exams or your shelf exams. But at the same time, I tutor you for like your upcoming USMLE exams. And again, the vast majority of people have done this with, they've been like super, super successful on their USMLE exams. That's one thing. Next thing is, I also offer these booster courses for the USMLE exam. So like it's like 10 hours for step 2 CK, step 3, and like the internal medicine like in-training exam / board exams, but it's 20 hours for step 1, because step 1 just has a crap ton of material. So basically this is something that's ideal for the end of a person's dedicated period, or when they feel like, you know, their knowledge base is pretty good. And essentially the thing that happens is that in a Q&A format, I will put things together for you. And my Q&A will be like from an MBME context Q&A. I kind of put most of the high yield concepts for you together in a very short time period. Again, most people have done this with, they've found out to be extremely helpful. You've said, oh, Divine, this was like the big boost I needed at the very end of my dedicated period to score me those extra points on my exam. And then I also do like one-on-one like advising, or I guess you can call it like coaching, for like if you're like a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so an AMCAS application. I can help you with things like personal statements, rec letters, editing applications, mock interviews. And then the final thing is, if you're a medicine resident and you're preparing for like the ABIM board exam or the internal medicine in-training exam, or you're a college student that needs tutoring for like Gen Chem, O Chem, physics, biochem, histology, physiology, I'd offer tutoring for all those things. I mean, you can probably tell from these podcasts that I really love tutoring. And again, as I said at the beginning, You can now find these podcasts on 3 podcast apps: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, like Google Play, essentially, and then Spotify. I have all those on them. And as I add new podcasts, they'll be updated automatically on those apps. Although I will encourage you to also look at the website. You can actually download the podcast from there as well. And if I post slides for a given podcast, it will be on the website, not on these podcast apps, unfortunately. So have a wonderful rest of your day. Again, my apologies for this podcast taking essentially like an hour and 20 minutes. But this stuff is very high yield, and I feel like I covered a crap ton of topics. This is probably like maybe almost like, I probably covered like 15% of the first aid cardiology chapter in this one podcast. So I think you should find this to be useful. And again, remember that I have like 3 other podcasts in the series. And then in addition to that, I actually have like a cardio farm podcast. So all the pharmacology you ever see in first aid cardio, I've essentially covered all those in separate podcasts. Just again, go back, look on the website, you'll find those. So I will see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful rest of your day. God bless you. And I really do hope that the Lakers beat the Warriors tonight. See you next time. Thank you.